Hello there. Today is Wednesday, May 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, more big presidential primaries, but will the results make any difference?
We are in to the last ballot is cast.
U.S. service members win a fight for their faith. World leaders are still looking at how to deal with the crisis in Syria. The Senate takes action on Zika virus concerns. And also ahead, Money Monster at the movies. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, voters in the U.S. state of Kentucky are having their presidential primary today, with Democrats Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in a very divided race.
Today I voted for Bernie Sanders. I just think he's the one who best supports what I believe in, kind of equality and fairness for all people. And I've been with Bernie since about day one.
In the overall presidential race, Clinton holds a formidable lead of nearly 300 pledged delegates, and she is on track to clinch the Democratic nomination in early June. But she's trying to avoid primary defeats during that final stretch as she prepares for Republican Donald Trump. Sanders is favored to win in Oregon's primary. Well, this voter says she voted for Hillary and says she's worried about Donald Trump.
I don't mean to speak, you know, bad about Mr. Trump. I like to believe people are doing what they think is best. But he honestly terrifies me as far as the bigotry that I see and the division that he see, that I see him, and the, you know, the discrimination. I just not the way I want my grandchildren to live.
Now let's talk more about the race for the White House with VOA's Jim Malone.
It is a squeaker. Well over 400,000 votes cast in the Democratic primary in Kentucky, and the candidates are separated by at most a few thousand and perhaps hundreds of votes at the end of the day. So it's almost effectively a tie. I don't know that it does a lot of good for either candidate in one sense. Bernie Sanders needs to win these primaries by overwhelming margins to advance the delegate count he has and to try to catch up with Hillary Clinton. But Hillary Clinton has an image issue at stake here, where she is, by all accounts, the presumptive nominee with a path to the nomination that looks pretty good, and yet she can't quite put Bernie Sanders away. He keeps hanging in there and doing well in a number of these primaries. So, you know, the beat or the battle goes on, I think, for another week or two until we get into early June and the close of the primary season, and then we'll have to see where we are. But Clinton remains the very prohibitive favorite to be the nominee.
And how many delegates are at stake here in Kentucky, and how many will either of them get?
They're going to split it. That hurts Sanders, because Sanders needs to really pick up, you know, a few hundred delegates to catch Clinton at the end of the day. And it's just not going to happen at this pace. And that's really what's working in Clinton's favor, is the mathematics of all this. She has a 300 delegate or so lead in the pledged delegate count, but that does not take into effect or into account the so-called superdelegates. If you add those, her lead is much bigger, by 500 or so. So that's why most of the Democratic officials believe Clinton will be the nominee at the convention in Philadelphia in July. The issue here, though, is how does this race wind up? How does the party pull together? And we actually saw a troubling incident in Nevada last weekend, where Sanders supporters at a Democratic convention in the state of Nevada were very upset with some rulings and threw chairs and basically caused a ruckus. And that has Democrats worried about their own convention. Will the Sanders followers accept Hillary Clinton as the nominee when the time comes? Because right now, there's just no path for Sanders to overtake her in the delegate count.
Is he going to end up being considered somewhat of a spoiler?
Well, I think there are some concerns in Democratic circles now that it could be a potential problem. And the reason is that they now look at Donald Trump in a different light. Recent polls have shown a close race for November. Democrats are starting to realize it's not going to be a cakewalk, and they need the party unified. And the first step there is going to have Sanders get behind Clinton and, most importantly, bring his followers with him and the enthusiasm they showed for him. Now, will that be automatically transferred to Clinton? Probably not. But she is desperately going to need those young voters that he's been able to inspire, some of the independent voters he's drawn into his campaign.
He doesn't seem like he's really ready to even consider that.
At this point, you know, he's still in the throes of the primary battle. He's looking ahead to the next primaries, especially in California on June 7th. Sanders, as the results were coming in this evening in Kentucky and Oregon, was holding a rally in California. So he's full speed ahead right through the end of the primaries. He wants as strong a showing as possible so that by the time they get to the convention, he may be trailing in the delegate count, but he will be able to wield influence on the platform. And that particularly will go probably to the economic points in the platform and his concerns about economic inequality. But I think you're starting to see, beginning with party officials like the party chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, she says she's not concerned about how this is all going to wind up. The party will be unified. But I think other Democrats on background are a little more concerned now that they want Clinton to be on a glide path to the nomination and then to have the party united behind her so she can take on Donald Trump, because they know already it's going to be a very negative, very tough campaign once we get past the party conventions in July.
And by the way, Donald Trump now only needs fewer than 100 delegates to clinch the Republican nomination for president. He picked up 9 delegates in Guam on Tuesday. Now let's take a look at what's trending online with our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori.
What is happening? What are we talking about today online?
We're talking about someone who became quite famous literally overnight, but probably not for a reason you want to be famous for. A congressional candidate in Virginia accidentally revealed his habit of watching adult films by sharing a screen grab on Facebook. DCist, a website about Washington, D.C., captured it the best in a tweet that reads like this. Porn-watching Virginia politician fails to close tabs, claims to be researching computer viruses.
Of course he is. So who is this person and how did it all unfold?
His name is Mike Webb, and he's running for Congress in Virginia's 8th District. He's running as an independent after losing the Republican primary and posted an attack against his opponent on Facebook Monday afternoon. And boy, did it backfire. His post included a screenshot from a web browser where he forgot to close the tabs, and two of the tabs had questionable titles.
Wow. What's the reaction like on social media?
A little bit like the one that you just gave. And also, many people seem to be, quote-unquote, more concerned about his choice of search engine than the search results. Tampa, Florida-based anchor Jameson Euler tweeted, Mike Webb should be ashamed and embarrassed. He uses Yahoo for his search engine. In America, most people prefer to use Google. Another Twitter user wrote, Mike Webb uses Yahoo as a search engine. Embarrassing. Vote him out. And yes, hashtag Mike Webb is a trending hashtag. Other people expressed dismay for how long the story is staying on the web. A user named Alex Chiba tweeted, For the love of God, does Mike Webb have no friends on the internet? Hashtag Mike Webb, it's still up. No kidding, more than 32,000 people are talking about him on Facebook alone.
That's incredible, G. Maybe he thinks no publicity is bad publicity.
A good idea.
What else is trending?
American billionaire George Soros lowered his stock holdings in the U.S. by 37% and spent the money instead in buying gold. He was once quoted as saying gold is the best investment in a recession. Many media outlets are tweeting about the story first reported by Bloomberg. Lori?
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the other stories we are following on VOANews.com. The U.S. Senate okays 9/11 lawsuits against Saudi Arabia. The first openly gay chief of a U.S. military branch is confirmed by the Senate. The world's largest plane touches down in Australia. The U.S. military is looking at sites for a second Africa base. And a filmmaker explores how to love things climate can't change. For in-depth coverage of these stories and much more, head to our website at voanews.com or download our mobile app. This is International Edition. And VOA's International Edition continues. The U.S. Senate has approved $1.1 billion to combat the Zika virus. Tuesday's vote came months after U.S. health officials first warned that Zika could spread through large swaths of the nation. The mosquito-borne Zika virus can cause devastating birth defects and has been linked to a debilitating neurological disorder. Democratic Senator Patty Murray has urged swift action.
Americans are justifiably worried about the Zika virus, as the failure to prevent its spread could have devastating consequences for our families.
The Senate-approved Zika measure faces an uncertain fate in the House of Representatives, where majority Republicans are considering a proposal to redirect $622 million previously appropriated to fight Ebola. Well, members of the 17-nation International Syria Support Group are meeting in Vienna to find ways to bolster the cessation of hostilities and provide humanitarian access to besieged communities. A senior U.S. official told reporters Tuesday the target of August 1st to have a framework in place for a political transition in Syria remains an objective. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Italian counterpart in Vienna talked about one major reason, as he sees it, for the lack of progress in Syria.
Russia has made it very clear to us, at least, that President Assad has made a series of commitments to them, that he's prepared to engage seriously in Geneva in the transitional negotiation of the Geneva process, that he's prepared to have constitutional reform, prepared to have an election. Those are three major commitments. And we have yet to see President Assad live up to commitment number one, which is negotiate in good faith on the transition.
VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins is traveling with Secretary Kerry. She tells International Edition host Susan Yackey more regarding the Syria from Tuesday's meeting.
In a joint news conference with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and UN Special Envoy Stephane de Mistura, Kerry spelled out the measures the ISSG had agreed on to help reduce violence and spur the delivery of humanitarian aid in Syria. He said the group agreed that if a party to the ceasefire persistently violated the truce, then that party could be excluded from the agreement. He also said that as of June 1st, the World Food Program would make arrangements to accelerate airdrops and regular air flights into designated besieged areas if relief workers were denied humanitarian access. Also, the group urged rebels to disassociate themselves from Islamic State and al-Nusra Front terrorists. Lavrov said there had been a number of cases in which terrorist groups had made alliances with these groups that were part of the ceasefire. Now, Kerry appeared slightly irritated by a question on whether the U.S. was losing the ability to exert pressure on President Bashar al-Assad's regime to fully comply with agreements such as the adherence to the ceasefire, supporting talks on a political transition, and allowing unrestricted access to besieged areas for humanitarian aid. His response was, the United States of America always has leverage.
Was there optimism about Syria's future?
Well, the best way that I would describe it is that the process was mixed. Kerry Lavrov and de Mistura noted the ceasefire violations, the problems with getting in humanitarian access in some areas, and also the challenges with the political talks. But they all seemed resigned to forge ahead to try to implement the agreements that had been put in place.
So what is next on the support group's agenda?
It's unclear at this point when the group will meet again. More than likely, the next meeting will be in Geneva, and that would involve the UN-facilitated proximity talks between the Syrian regime and the opposition. UN envoy Dina Stewart declined to set a date. He said there were several factors, such as the upcoming Ramadan holiday. He also said he wanted to see if the cessation of hostilities improved, as well as the efforts to get humanitarian aid delivered.
That's VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins in Vienna. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a review on the hot new George Clooney, Julia Roberts film. But first, imagine having to choose between your faith and serving your country. For American Six, serving in the U.S. military means not being able to follow certain tenets of their religion, including having long hair and a beard and wearing a turban. But some are slowly pushing back in the fight for religious rights. VOA correspondent Aru Pandey sat down with a U.S. Army captain and Bronze Star recipient who recently received an accommodation from the U.S. Army, and she joined me in studio to talk more about it.
Just in the last month or two, we've seen four different service members receive accommodations from the Army to be able to wear their turban, have their long hair, of course, in their turban and their beard, which is huge because until now, the number of people who were able to do that at active military were, I mean, a handful. So we're really seeing this push from both service members who want to be able to say, you know what, I'm a Sikh and I want to be faithful to my religion, but also be able to be faithful to my country. And so for this individual, this captain that I talked to, his story was amazing because he had a beard and a turban, I mean, for, you know, his life. And when he decided to join the military, his family had a long history in the military. When he decided to join the military and was at West Point, he talked about how he had to shave off that beard and take off that turban. And I can imagine for someone, you know, it doesn't matter what your faith is or what your beliefs are, but if there's something that you believe in and have done so for so many years, your entire life, and to say, you know what, because of my desire to serve my country, I'm going to do this. I thought that was really interesting. It wasn't where he came in to the military with a beard and then applied for a waiver and then got the waiver. It was, you know what, I'm going to do this. I'm going to shave my beard off. I'm going to get rid of the turban and I'm going to serve. I'm going to become an Army Ranger and I'm going to be deployed to Afghanistan. And then he ends up coming to a celebration at the Pentagon and he looks around the room and he sees all these other Sikhs who have the turban, not a whole bunch, but he went up and said, hey, how are you able to have your uniform and have your turban and be active duty? And they said, well, I applied for a waiver and it's a very long process, but, you know, do it. And he decided to do it. And it took a year. Basically, what happened was they had to file a lawsuit against the Department of Defense saying it's discriminatory. Mm-hmm. The Pentagon ended up, you know, granting that religious accommodation. Now, there are soldiers in the military, obviously, who have beards for medical reasons. And then we have cases where special forces. But this was for religious accommodation. So I think that was what the landmark, why this was such a landmark decision.
And you write that it was really difficult for him to have to make the choice between his country and his faith, and now he apparently doesn't have to do that.
No, and the problem is this is a temporary waiver. It's a temporary accommodation. When I asked him about that, I said, look, you know, you're going to have to, they could say at any time, we want to see you put your, you know, gas mask on and make sure that, and he said, look, I don't even want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about what I have to do. The point is, I will do it. I have done it. I will continue to do my job. I talked to another service member, Major Khalsa, who had a different take. He said, you know, yeah, and it's not right that they have to continue to check on us and see if we are complying and meeting their standards. Mm-hmm. There should not be this type of process for us, this laborious process where we have to go through a lawsuit. They should just have permanent regulations that allow members of the Sikh religion to wear the, you know, and obviously be conforming. I mean, if you see the turbans that they wear in uniform match their uniform. And, you know, both individuals I talked to say they've never had a problem with uniformity. None of their colleagues in the military have ever come up to them and said, look, you know, we were bothered by this. They said it's not a problem at all. It hasn't affected morale. It hasn't affected unit cohesion. So what these individuals are asking for, and the Sikh coalition saying, look, the military should look into having standards that apply so that it doesn't have to go on a case-by-case basis.
It seems like you shouldn't have to choose between your faith and your country if you want to serve your country.
Right.
Freedom of religion.
Right.
It's part of
and,
the American process.
And the Sikh religion is actually rooted in service, and they were known to be the warriors and the fighters, and for the fighters against injustice. That's a tenet of their faith, and fighting for equality. So for them, this is a big part of it. And they say, look at other militaries in other countries. I mean, Britain, Canada. I mentioned the Canada's defense minister. Sorry, is a Sikh, wears a turban. Has been deployed all over the world, including Afghanistan. And so other countries don't seem to have an issue. So they're saying, well, why does the United States military have an issue?
Does it look like that's about to change permanently?
Four accommodations recently in the last month. So they're saying that's progress and that's chipping away. And if you do look historically in over the last 5-10 years at how the military has changed in terms of being more inclusive, we've seen certain policies with LGBT. So there has been progress, and the service members I talked to say that they are on a path to progress. It's slow and it's deliberate, but they're hoping that it'll continue and maybe there'll be some more long-term permanent solutions in place.
And you can read Aru's entire story on our website at voanews.com. Money Monster, a new movie directed by Jodie Foster, starring George Clooney and Julia Roberts, is the latest film to tackle the huge gap between the uber-rich 1% and everyone else. And though it's not the first film to be made on the subject, Money Monster is the most emotional and star-studded production about the corrupting power of money, according to VOA's Penelope Pulu. And I talked to her about it.
What is unique is it appeals to the masses. This is the Wall Street hitting Main Street on the large screen, and it is not by accident that you have huge Uber celebrities like Clooney and Julia Roberts playing the main characters, because they popularize the problem. Clooney plays the anchor in the show, who is taken hostage by this delivery man. And Julia Roberts plays Clooney's producer, who is in his ear all the time, trying not only to save his life, but to find answers to a very pressing situation. What happened that day? And $800 million was lost in ether, and poses a lot of questions. Can we lose money like that because of a glitch? Does it always have to be some sort of a human fingerprint there, which in that case it was? And where do the masses stand by looking at and eating up news that they have gotten used to eating up without asking the main questions? And this is what this film addresses.
And you seem to think it's very relatable as opposed to some other movies that may not be, if you're not super, in tune with what's happening on Wall Street.
Absolutely. I mean, I have seen other films that structurally, in terms of plot, in terms of in-depth analysis, were superior to Money Monster by far. Charles Ferguson got an Oscar for best director and best documentary back for a film he made, Inside Job, it's called, in 2010. He was a real insider. You watch this documentary, you're going to get angry, you're going to get shocked, but the numbers are going to evade you, unless you're a math major, Same with A Big Short, which got an Oscar nomination this past season. Again, cool dudes there. You have the Brad Pitts, you have the Christian Bales, the Stephen Carells, the occasional babes trying to explain algorithms, But it's chaotic. Again, you don't really get it unless you know stocks.
Right.
This one does not speak about stocks. This doesn't speak about value. This speaks about feelings. This speaks about what people have to lose when they lose everything and what happens when they pick up a gun and strap somebody with an explosives vest, an anchor, and they ask for answers. And that taps to a lot of people's anger.
Well, it certainly makes me want to go see it.
Well, it's literally, Money Monster is Main Street asks questions of Wall Street during an election period. Jodie Foster is pretty good as filmmaker, too.
Oh, right. This was directed by Jodie Foster.
That's right, yeah.
What did she have to say about producing the film?
She actually feels that this was the exception to her rule. Usually she does more esoteric films, more character-driven films. This was character-driven to an extent, but she does go for the action, for the tension. And so she sees the film intentionally as a combination of a popcorn film, which will give people a lot of insight and a lot of things to chew on.
You can watch highlights of the film and hear her full review at voanews.com. That's going to do it for this edition of International Edition. We'll be back tomorrow. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Colombia is in the final stages of striking a peace agreement with the Rebel Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as FARC. That would end a 52-year conflict that has taken the lives of more than 250,000, left 45,000 people missing, and displaced 6.8 million. At a recent meeting with the Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry encouraged both sides to come to a final agreement. He stressed that the United States is very committed to not just helping to achieve the document, but to helping achieve true peace in Colombia. In a promising step, the Colombian government and FARC announced that they had reached an agreement to release child soldiers under 15 years of age from rebel custody and develop a roadmap for an exit for the remaining minors, those between 15 and 18. The deal would eventually involve hundreds of children who were recruited to fight in Colombia's long civil war, though no census of child soldiers has ever been taken. One of the biggest horrors of a conflict is when we drag our children and young people into combat, said Humberto de la Calle, the chief Colombian government negotiator. It's for this reason that this agreement is a crucial advance in the process of bringing this war to a close. The United States, said Secretary Kerry, will continue to lend its support during the post-accord process. Colombia will need help, he said, in areas such as humanitarian demining. And we're working with the president and with his team to define the details of the demining initiative, which we're working on with Norway as co-chairs of that effort, also to help with the post-accord implementation, which will require significant global commitment. President Santos expressed his gratitude to the United States for its crucial support in the peace process. We hope that in the near future we can complete the accord and start building a true peace. The United States remains deeply committed to helping Colombia begin a new chapter in its history, one of reconciliation and peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.